Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing our recent back issue purchases as well as reviewing a classic comic storyline.
Okay, the comics we'll be discussing in this episode originally came out in 1987. That's right, we're going all the way back that far to talk about Mike Grell's Green Arrow, The Longbow Hunters. Joining me and Bob for this episode is our good friend Jonathan Carroll. How you doing, John?
Not too bad.
Cool. And as we usually do on the Back Issue Spotlight, we start out by finding out just how big of a haul Bob has had lately on his back issue buying sprees. So, how's the total up this time, Bob?
A spree it was. Well, I don't know if it's much of a spree, but I got Action Comics 351. That gives me 348 and up. I've got Adventure Comics 300, 306, and 316. Those are all Legion of Superheroes books. Aquaman 43. Batlash 1 and 6 from the original series, Batman 240 and 243, Detective 334 and 341, got 80-page Giant number 11, Flash 195, Green Lantern 69 and 71. I picked up the Western Johnny Thunder, which is a three-issue series from DC back in the 70s. That I had never seen before, and picked up issue 2 of that. Now I have to be on the lookout for the other 2 of those. I got 9 issues of Jonah Hex. I'm down to needing only 2 more to complete my Jonah Hex run. Strange Tales 121, 122, and 127. That's Superman 197. I've been working on Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen. I got 13 issues of Lois and 23 issues of Jimmy. I now have Jimmy Olsen from 131 on up. And Thor, I got Thor 129 and Journey into Mystery 111. Weird Western 35 and 69. Those are some more Jonah Hex. Well, the 35 was Jonah Hex, 69 was Scalp Hunter. I'm zeroing in and finishing off Weird Western also. Wonder Woman 186 and 187. Those are all my old things. And from recent stuff, I picked up Walking Dead number 4. That leaves me with only 1 issue to go to complete my Walking Dead run. Picked up Supernatural Law, about 6 issues of that. Picked up out of dollar bins. I saw, I was at a little local event the other day, and they had Conan number 58 from the original series that we just talked about on back at the last back issue slotlight. It's the first Baylete issue.
Right, right.
It was in a dollar bin. So, oh. Okay. I have it already, but I picked up another copy for a dollar because I'll just like stick it up on a shelf or something so I could look at it. It's not in my long box. And same thing with Nova number 1, the original Nova number 1, for a buck. I figured, okay, it was in better condition than the copy that I bought off the rack and read 30 times back in the 70s. They also had Star Reach number 1, which had Jim Starlin, Howard Chaykin, called Howie Chaykin in this back then, and Walt Simonson stories in it. And then out of 50 cent bins, I got Captain America, The Chosen, number 2. Need only 1 more of those. I got Fool Killer, number 1 and 3, the Marvel Max series. Frazetta's Dark Kingdom, that was a one-shot. And all those were all $3.99 books that I picked up out of 50 cent bins that I had chosen not to get. Kissing Chaos, I got 4 of the 8 issues of that series from Oni Press. Metal Men Mini number 4, which again, I had stopped getting that after the first or second issue, and I've now got all but 1 issue of that out of 50 cent bins. And I got issues 13 through 20 of Midnighter. So again, I stopped getting Midnighter after about issue 8, and I have now completed that series out of 50 cent bins.
Well, that's impressive, but it's also a little worrisome because it's sounding like you're finding a lot of good, well, not good, but, you know, decent recent stuff in these 50 cent bins, which means a lot of stores are really, you know, losing some money on some of these, particularly the $3.99 ones.
Yes, there's no way a store is not losing money on selling a $3.99 book for 50 cents. So at least on that particular book. Now, maybe they sold, I don't know what the sales figures were on Captain America the Chosen, but I totally skipped that series, and I have been able to pick up 5 of the 6 issues out of 50-cent bins.
Well, I mean, figure, you know, the store's paying half the cover price. Now they're going to pay a little more, a little less, depending on the volume they do and all that kind of stuff. But let's just say 50 cents to make the math easy. That was a $3.99 book, so they're paying about $2 for it. You bought it for 50 cents, so that meant, you know, there's 3 other copies that they, you know, had to be making money on to pay for that one. You know what I mean? It's it almost, I don't want to say it doesn't matter how many they sold. Obviously it does. But, you know, a store puts too much stuff into that 50 cent bin. That's really going to hurt them in the long term, if not the immediate short term, too.
Well, there's one other thing you can think of. I know some stores have a policy of if it's held after a month for their or 2 months for their subscription people, they charge the credit card for it. Could it be that they're charging people for them and then just turning around and then selling them out because people say they don't want them? Or, I know that's kind of dirty, but I know some stores do that.
I've never really run into a store that does that, but...
Yeah, most stores I'm familiar with, after that kind of time, they'll obviously have made an attempt to get in touch with the person with the pull list, but they'll just shut down the pull list and put the stuff out on the rack.
Yeah.
But regardless, if they have to sell it for, you know, a quarter of what they're paying for it, you know, obviously they're losing money on that.
Yeah,
well, I was to ask you, how big are these stores, Bob? Are they big stores, small stores?
Well, they're mostly not, you know, I don't find these bins in stores generally, more like at like a little local convention kind of place, you know.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like we've got this thing called Frank and Sons, which is kind of a warehouse where a couple of times a week, you know, they've got dealers come in and they're setting up and they've got little booths and stuff. So it's not like I'm going into a store. Usually a store, with the exception of Wild Pig, right, they don't have tremendous amounts of 50-cent bins of recent stuff. Usually you see the 50-cent bins with the, you know, more of the stuff from the last year at more of a local show kind of a place that's not in the actual shop. Although I have seen shops that go down to like a buck or something on things. I was in a store in San Diego about a year ago where, you know, everything that was more than 3 months old that was on their rack, they knocked the price down to a buck. And then a local store here, back on Free Comic Book Day, they had a sale where everything that was not, you know, the most current stuff, you know, again, the last couple of months, a lot of the stuff that they had extra stock in, they made it all a buck.
Well, and there's definitely, you know, something to be said for a store to take that stuff and, you know, at least recoup as much of the loss as they can, blowing it out for a buck or 50 cents or what have you, rather than, you know, be stuck with the money tied up in dead inventory.
I mean, if it's a sale event and you've got a lot of foot traffic in, you know, you can maybe drive up. And then the other piece is maybe, and it doesn't work for miniseries, which a lot of these things were miniseries. The ones I picked up this time, they were all either miniseries or series that had been canceled. You know, things like that, I don't think that you're going to be selling those because historically, what sells as back issues are stuff that has an ongoing interest in them.
Yeah.
You know, once something ends, people aren't going to be looking for it because they're not trying to fill in a hole as a general rule. I mean, even something as popular as Sandman, you know, it's not really being put out anymore. So back issues on that don't appear to be things that fly off the shelves, you know, like something like a major, you know, Spider-Man or something like that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Once the series ends, the interest in that series is back issues, you know, it drops off a lot of people's radar.
Yeah. I mean, like, you look at, like, the Metal Men miniseries that DC did. I mean, I saw lots of issues of Infinity Inc., you know, like,
oh,
interestingly,
yeah.
I didn't even buy them out of the 50-cent bin, but You know, you have a series like that from DC, and now that that series is over, how many people are really going to be looking to pick those up if they end up off the rack and just in the bag, you know, priced up a quarter over cover price or whatever, just in the back issue bin? How long would that sit in a store's inventory?
Well, even if they stay on the rack at cover price, who's going to pick those up versus getting the trade?
Right.
I mean, so,
very, very, very few.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, the stores need to make that choice. I mean, that, I think what it comes down to is they need to really manage their ordering in a given month to order around what they think they can sell. Now, that being said, that gets into a dangerous position, because that's where you get into the place where they're just not ordering lots of things. Now, that's something that I've seen as a feature with stores, but they implement it in kind of a strange way, because historically what they'll do is, well, I don't want to get stuck with a lot of back issues, so what I'm going to do is I'm not going to order any at all of all these interesting indie books. But I'll still order boatloads of the Marvel and DC books, and that's usually what they end up getting stuck with.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking for Golly number 2 from Image, and I went into like 4 different stores, and not a single one of them had a copy. I went into 4 stores before I went where I knew they would have it. None of them had it. None of them even bought one in the first place. And this is a book from Image. Now, I think the first issue sold, we talked about it on the back issue on the Mayo report, I think about 3,300, something like that.
I think so.
The second issue, all these shops didn't even have a single copy. I went into Comics, Toons, and Toys, which is, you know, they really good in indie. He had 14 copies left on the rack. Still, I mean, it just came out this week. He orders a decent amount. He had ordered 20, though, because I asked him. So that means he sold 6 already, and I just bought a 7th from him,
mm-hmm.
You know, because it's there to buy. The other people are like, nah, I didn't order it, you know, but they all had copies of, you know, all the other Marvel and DC miniseries that will probably end up, you know, cool in time. And I don't have to buy a lot, but I mean, it just seems like if they'd order one copy of something like Golly, then maybe someone would buy it.
Well, it's funny you mentioned stores getting burned by the Marvel and DC stuff. There was a gaming store here in town that was trying to get into comics. I haven't been in lately, so I don't know kind of where they wound up on this. And this was 6 months, a year ago, probably. Actually, over a year ago, I think. And it was around the time that Firestorm got canceled, Sword of Aquaman, I mean, and Hawk Girl maybe, and a few others. And the approach they had taken was kind of a shotgun approach of, let's just order a smattering of the DC, Marvel, Dark Horse, Image stuff, toss it on the shelf, and see what sells. Which I thought was a intriguing decision. And, of course, you know, the minute titles like Firestorm ended, and they still had, you know, 3 or 4 copies of the last 4 or 5 issues, they're never going to sell that, because there's no increase. I mean, there's nothing sustaining the demand for Firestorm at that point. And obviously the demand wasn't enough to keep the title going. So, yeah, I think it's all too easy for a store to get stuck with dead inventory in that respect. And sometimes almost through no fault of their own. But it comes down to, you know, this is where a point-of-sale system can really save a store and be very beneficial, even though they're not, you know, cheap to put in either cost-wise or manpower-wise. But the better you can monitor your sales and react to what is and isn't moving, the better off you are. But I think this also goes to the point where trades have really cut into the back issue market.
Well, particularly in Marvel and DC. I was listening to the latest issue of Cryptographic, and they were talking to Kat and Josh, who do Titanium Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And Josh was saying, oh yeah, well, you know, we will eventually put out a trade on this, but we won't if nobody buys the monthly book and we end up having to cancel it or something. You know, it's like, You know, he said, you can wait for the trade on a Marvel or DC book because they will put out a trade no matter what. Well, not in every case, as you found out from, like, Family Dynamic, right?
Who knows?
Pull the plug on that. You know, maybe they'll put out a three-issue trade.
They may still put a trade out, but yeah.
But, you know, you can generally count on the fact that, you know, the Metal Men trade is going to come out. The Infinity Inc. trade is going to come out. I mean, they put out a trade of almost anything.
Yeah.
But an indie book that people do not buy monthly, the chances of, even from Image, you know, I look at what happened with M-Theory over from Shadowline, you know, it's like they canceled that thing. I mean, and maybe Dwight will put out his own trade of that eventually, but, you know, that's very iffy on the waiting for trade mentality if you move outside of the realm of Marvel and DC, even to Image. I would say that there's not a 100% guarantee that there will be a Golly trade, for instance, if, you know, nobody buys the monthly issues.
Well, I would almost go so far as to say, certainly outside of DC and Marvel, to a lesser degree, sometimes even within Marvel and DC, if you do not support the monthly book, you are, in essence, particularly if you're waiting for that trade because you're interested in the book but not getting it, you know, as in the periodical format, you're almost, you know, killing the book. Now, that having been said, is it the reader's responsibility to support the book to make sure it keeps going out? Well, no, not really. But if you like the book, you want it to come out, don't you? So there's you know, a certain benefit to you if you do support it. And it's a really sticky issue because, I mean, I know there are a lot of people out there. It's like, well, you know, whether, you know, take Titanium Reign. You know, hopefully it's doing great. Hopefully it goes for the full 12-issue run. I certainly hope so. It is beautiful art. It's a great story. I certainly wish them the best possible success. But I got to imagine there are people out there thinking, well, I'll just pick it up when I do a trade or a hardcover. Well, again, like they were saying, if the monthly book doesn't work out, what incentive is there for them to do it in trade? You know, but
yeah,
there are going to be people out there thinking, well, it's not my job to support that. Well, I don't know.
That ties into why I don't buy trades hardly at all, because I do want these books to come out in a format that maybe somebody else can buy that 5-10 years from now that I didn't have, that because of my lack of support, they don't have the chance to buy. I want them to be able to buy it.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I tend not to buy trades of current ongoing titles. The trades I tend to buy are like the showcases, the Batman Superman Chronicles, stuff of older material. The things I'm buying currently in trade that are newer material are things that are original to trade, like the Sentinel stuff from Drumfish, like Empowered from Dark Horse. I rarely get any, you know, ongoing miniseries or ongoing from a publisher thinking I'll just wait for the trade. Now, that having been said, there are one or two publishers where I do that, and that's only because I feel I've been burned enough times where I'll get that monthly series, they'll cut it off early, and I've got to rebuy what I got in monthly in trade to get the full story. And, you know, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, you know, shame on you. I just, you know, again, there's one or two publishers out there where I'm just not going to play that game by and large.
I mean, for me, mostly, I don't wait for the trade, with the exception of a couple of Vertigo series that I kind of came into late and just said, okay, I'll just buy those and trade. Although several of those, like Fables and Jag of the Fables, I have switched back and started buying the monthlies. Because I enjoyed the book and want to support the book in monthly format. But mostly if I buy a trade, it's because the storyline was an exceptional storyline that I want to have that particular thing on my bookshelf in a collected format. You know, like the recent Superman and the Legion of Superheroes storyline that we did a back issue spotlight on. I actually picked that up in the trade format even though I had the monthlies, this Green Arrow Longbow Hunters that we're going to talk about in a little bit. I reread this in the trade because, again, I mean, I had bought the original issues, but I picked up a trade somewhere along the line to just keep that on my bookshelf. Because, again, really, really good stuff. I like to have so that if somebody says, oh, what about, you know, this? And it's like I don't have to pull out the comics. I can just pull the trade off the shelf, hand it to them and say, read this. And then, you know, let me know what you think.
Yeah, but that's where you're using the collected edition kind of to reward good stories,
yes,
not as an excuse to not get the monthly.
Absolutely, and that's pretty much how I buy. I mean, and again, you know, I'll go back and I'll buy the archives and I'll buy the, you know, masterworks and things like that. But for the most part on new series, I don't wait for the trade. I will buy the trade also if it was an exceptional run.
Yeah.
Again, with the, and I don't know why, but with the exception of Vertigo, you know, I do tend to get a variety of series of Vertigo in trade format. I pretty much bought Why the Last Man exclusively in trades. I bought 100 Bullets exclusively in trade. I bought Preacher in trade. I don't know why I do that with Vertigo, but they've trained me to do that.
I was going to say, they tend to do the first volume of a trade at a very competitive price, usually cheaper than the monthlies, and are kind of actively trying to get people hooked on the trades. So, yeah. I mean, it makes sense financially for people to go down that path.
Well, also, I think they're also pricing it for that way for the, not for the direct market as much as for the bookseller market.
Yeah.
That way they can get you in on, say, that $9.99 trade or that $8.99 trade. You go, oh, okay, and then you go up, and the next one's $12, and then $15 and $18, but you're invested in the title, so you're going to spend that money.
Well, and it's smart for them to do that first trade at a cheaper price, just where it's easier to kind of sample that, you know, at, be it at the bookstores or the comic stores.
That's why one thing I have noticed is a lot of Vertigo titles, I mean, the first story arc generally will be 5 issues, not 6 or 7.
Well, that, yeah, you're right. And that helps them have a lower price trade because there's less material in it.
I mean, think of the current Fables trade that's about, it's either hitting or just about to hit, the one that includes the war that they just had. I mean, how many issues is that? I think it's like 9, 10 issues. That's their biggest one. But you go all the way back to most of their story arcs are the 5, 6, 7 at most.
Well, and that first one was just the 5. And I'm pretty sure that trade was fairly competitively priced.
Even a lot of current ongoings, especially in the Vertigo, it's hard to find those back issues, those first issues. I mean, Fables is a little overpriced, is high. Get those first couple of 3 story arcs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and because they're in trade, you know, that's part of why the issues cost so much at that point, because stores knew they were going to come out and trade. They knew particularly the first trade was going to be probably competitively priced. And they may not have known that back then. I'm trying to think when Vertigo really got aggressive on the first trade aspect. And it may have been after, you know, the start of Fables, but I'd have to go look. And back issues are such a niche market these days that being able to, like you said, being able to find some of these issues, much less find them at a good price in a local setting can be difficult. I mean, it's part of why I do the overwhelming majority of my back issue purchasing online, is I can find much better deals.
I combine mine with some in my in-store. I mean, Bob, you left out the 50 comics I got for you, but I mean, I splatter between online and in the store, but this is how I buy.
Yeah, I think I mentioned those Hellblazer books on the last back issue spotlight.
Yeah, I think you did.
I haven't listened to that one yet. So.
But yeah, I mean, and that's another place, though. I mean, because you got that store was selling big bundles of Hellblazer books, right, for essentially $1 a copy. And that's a very good, you know, price point. You know, you can pick up a huge run of back issue titles for $1 a piece, even at a discount, you're paying more than $1 a piece for a comic as a rule, right?
Yeah.
So if you can get in-depth, large quantities of books for a cheap price, that's going to be, I mean, that's almost a better price than you would pay in the trade format. You know, it's like when even the trade, they only usually come down to about $1 a piece, you know.
And that's only if you get lucky, and that's only if DCBS or Inside Trade has them for, like, cheap.
Right. You know, so.
I want to get into my buying. I mean, I buy a lot now. I mean, I mostly buy on eBay and in store and at cons and everything, but I'm not going to pay more than I'm not going to pay more than $1 to $1.50 for a lot of the stuff I buy, because I mostly buy stuff from the early 90s to the current. But I mean, there's a couple of places I buy online where I don't know where this guy's getting his stuff, because I mean, most of the stuff is in very fine, good condition. Some of it is near mint, and I'm buying it for $1.50 to $2 an issue, and he's putting up auctions of these maybe once every 2-3 months of these same titles.
That is interesting, because it implies a steady supply of runs, which is impressive. Yeah. So what all have you bought?
Let's see, in store. Now, this is going back to when I first really started buying, thanks to you. I hate you guys. We're going to call it May 1, roughly. Since then, I've gotten complete run of, which I bought about a month ago, complete run of JLA and JLE, JLI, that whole smattering, that whole mess. Complete run of Legion, Post, Crisis, Legionnaires, Teen Titans, Young Justice. I finished that run. I've been grabbing that out of bins for a while. Complete run of Our Man. Probably about 150 to 200 comics in the CrossGen universe. I've got to go back and figure out what I have. I need to actually buy one of those comic book programs and get that. Also, a lot of JLA one-off series. What was that one that you guys mentioned? I cannot remember the name of it, where everybody lost their powers except for the...
World Without... No, what the hell was that one?
The World Without... It was like a three-issue one. I can't remember.
I know the one you're talking about.
I had bought that and not even known about it. Listened to the Back Issue Spotlight where y'all mentioned that just as a one-off, and I was like, wait a minute, I have this right here. Let me read it. But yeah, let's see, a complete run of Outsiders, all series. What else? Right now, I'm actually online as we speak by, and I'm getting a couple things, Aquaman, Vigilante.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that horrible series from the mid-80s, Action Comics, pretty much from Crisis on, which is actually tied into why I ended up getting I liked that Superman of the Legion so much, I actually went out and bought the hardcover.
Cool.
Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, a complete run of that. Azrael, a complete run of Green Arrow, both series. Yeah, it ties into this. Green Lantern, the post-89 reboot.
How many boxes have you filled with all of this stuff? I mean, the runs you're talking about, some of them are, you know, at least, like Vigilante is one of the shorter ones at 50 issues. Some of these are, like, you know, 100 plus or in some cases even more than that.
Current issues I've got about, and this is really funny because I've only really started collecting in the last 3.5-4 years. Yes, I'm 31 and I just started collecting. I got into comics 5 years ago. Yeah, shut up. I've got current comics. I've got about 7 long boxes. I've got about another 4 actually in long boxes of books that I've bought. And I've got probably still in the packaging boxes sent to me from the people I bought them from, probably the equivalent of about another 5-6.
Wow. Those are some really great runs you're picking up, too.
Well, you know, the one thing that's interesting is, you know, if you don't have, and I kind of envy you to some extent, because you can pick up for not that much money tremendous, tremendous quantities of really pretty good comics. I mean, there are lots of comics from the 80s to today. I mean, there were some dark years there in the 90s, but even there were, you know, bright shining, you know, gems that occurred in the 90s as well. There was a lot of really good comics that you can buy out there for a dollar or less an issue in runs and even in single issues. And, you know, when you look at how much a new comic costs off the rack, you know, it's like almost, man, instead of buying new comics, if you don't have all these comics, go and buy some of this other stuff. You're going to get just as much enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm buying, and what's funny is I'm not paying more than $1 to $1.50, maybe $2 an issue. The most I paid for a run was I paid $40 for a 25-issue run of Green Arrow. And that was because it included the 101 issue, and the person I was bidding against wanted it a lot. I mean, there's been some times where I've been buying, and I've just get to the point, I'm like, no, I'm not going to go any higher, because I was trying to buy a complete run of Supergirl, the Peter David Supergirl, and I ended up dropping out of the bidding on it when it was at about, I think it was $60 for the first 30 issues. And I was like, I'm not going to pay that much. It's like, I know this will be popped up later, and I can get it then.
Yeah. Well, and knowing how much you're willing to pay is a smart move.
That's a healthy eBay attitude. I just don't like getting into bidding wars on eBay. You know, it's kind of like you determine what you're willing to pay for something. And if, like, for instance, if the most you're willing to pay is about $1.50 an issue, let's say, and it's 30 issues up there, you know, once it goes over 45, I'm out, and there, it'll come up again, you know, unless it's like a piece of original art or something where there literally is only one of them in existence, you know, any kind of comic book, regular comic book or toy that comes up on eBay, there will be another of them, I can guarantee.
And like right now, the guy that I buy from online, he has JLA from 74 to when it ended, the last series, that series ended, the first series ended. He has all of the, he's got those in blocks on for sale. A lot of them are up above $30 a piece. So, I mean, for the runs, and I'm just like, okay, I know these people probably have their maximum bids up close to $70 or so, but I'm not going to pay it because I know these runs will pop up again, and I might be able to buy them also later on and at us shows and everything. So there's also, people are willing to pay stupid prices for bad comics as well. Remember the Deathstroke series?
Yeah.
And this is just right now, looking at it, they end in about 5 hours. The first 30 are right now going for, current bid is $35. The second one is for $38. I mean, sometimes you just gotta look and go, is that really what that, I think that's worth? Like you said, I mean, I don't think it's worth anywhere near that. To somebody else, it might be.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's a lot to be said for, you know, and again, I'm kind of with Bob, envying your position here because, I mean, basically everything you've listed off, I got off the rack, so I've got these things. But if I were getting into comics new now or recently and didn't have all this stuff, I mean, man, being able to go and get in blocks, you know, the entire run of, you know, the Legion, Legionnaires, New Teen Titans, Justice League, a lot of the other stuff you were listing off, you know, that's such a great thing because you get all that, you can read through the entire run of the series without having to wait, you know, that month or whatever between issues, you know, read as many as you want at one sitting or space them out, what have you, and do it at much cheaper in a lot of cases than the current comics are going. I mean, how can you go wrong with that?
I mean, the reason that I'm doing this is because pretty much everything that I've got is stuff that I'm not going to be able to find a trade of.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, virtually nothing pre-1990 is coming out in new trade. And a lot of that stuff from the 80s is not going to come out in trade ever.
Just as an example, put it into context what we're talking about right now. The same dollar bin that I pulled that Conan number 58 and Nova number 1 out of had all three issues of Green Lantern Longbow Hunters in it.
Yeah,
so, I mean, for $3, and who has the original? Do you have the original issues, John?
Yep.
What was the cover price on those?
$2.95.
Yeah,
okay, so for less than the original book cost 30 years ago, right? 20 years ago. Yeah. 20 years ago, you can buy those comics. And, you know, this is also an example of the principle that Green Arrow, well, I like Green Arrow. He does not have an ongoing series. He does not have an ongoing, he has an ongoing series with, he doesn't have a wildly popular ongoing series that is driving up the value of back issue stuff related to Green Arrow.
Well, I would.
He has the Green Arrow Black Canary series. Obviously.
I would say that in this particular case, he's got an ongoing series. He's had one on and off for a while, but he has not had one that drives people back towards Longbow Hunters.
Right.
Because I would argue that the, and we'll talk more about it when we actually talk about the series, the pendulum has swung away from that end of the spectrum to kind of where it is now, and there's definite differences in the character, in the backstory, etc. And it's more than just, you know, does he have an ongoing series? Because right now he's splitting it with Black Canary, certainly. But again, does it drive people back to this? It's just like, I would argue, the current Green Lantern stuff, particularly now they've just done the Secret Origins story, no longer is really driving people back towards Emerald Dawn and Emerald Dawn 2. It's not as relevant as it was before. So it's kind of interesting.
And also that the current series being with the focus it is such on Hal, I mean, there's nothing driving people back. Even with Green Lantern Corps, there's really nothing driving people to buy the Kyle Rayner Green Lantern.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, as we've pointed out, I mean, Green Arrow is one of the Super B-listers. I mean, but unlike a lot of Super B-listers, he was able to sustain his own title first for over 100 issues before he got replaced by his son. And then his last one was 75 issues, and this current one will probably go probably to 50 or so before they cancel it.
Yeah, so...
Well, it'll go for two authors past the point where Geoff Johns leaves the series, I think. If Geoff Johns stays on the series for 200 issues, I'll bet it'll go for 200 issues, but I just don't see that happening.
Johns doesn't do Green Arrow, does he?
I thought you were talking about Green Lantern.
Oh, yeah, Lantern. Yeah, Lantern will probably... Well, if they bring back Winnick, I mean... Yeah, Green Arrow... Green Lantern just depends on who they have, what the focus is.
No, I think, though, that Bob's point is kind of interesting, is... Whenever you've got a title that gets kind of relaunched fairly strong with a particular creative team, and, you know, you can go a creative team switch or two beyond that before it kind of peters out, if...
And then they relaunch it again.
Yeah.
Like a Flash, as an example.
You could argue over on the Marvel side, Black Panther, Moon Knight. I'm trying to think of a few others that have kind of popped up and gotten, you know, replaced, revamped, what have you, in terms of titles a few times. You know, on the DC side, Aquaman, Hawkman, Martian Manhunter to a much lesser degree. I mean, there are a number of characters that they're going to throw out there if it goes, you know, and clicks. You know, once that creative team leaves, if, you know, the next one or two doesn't really sustain it or keep it going, they'll usually, you know, seem to cancel it and start it over with another hot creative team. So it's kind of interesting. So you guys want to hear about what I've bought?
Sure.
Lay it on us.
I've actually bought way too much lately. I filled at least another drawer box or two with my purchases. Actually, just one in a short box, I guess. I picked up Adventure Comics 453 to 457. That was some of the Superboy stuff. I may push back with that title into the Aquaman stuff, but I doubt I'll go through the Spectre stuff or further back. I don't know.
I will point out that the Aquaman and Spectre stuff in Adventure was really good stuff. In fact, that to me was the definitive run of Spectre, the Mike Flesher run. The Mike Flesher, Jim Aparo run of Spectre in Adventure Comics.
Some of that in reprints, and I'm just not a huge Spectre fan.
Well, John Carroll, that's something that you would probably like. The old Fleshers, they're not that expensive either.
I'll probably be at that point in probably about 5, 6, 7 years, because right now I'm trying to complete my 90s, then I'll move more into the 80s, and then I'll push into the 70s and 60s.
Yeah, it's funny, because I'm kind of doing the same thing. I'm trying to push back to, you know, at this point, finishing out the 80s, which I don't have much left for, and then into the 70s.
Just as a digression here, a theory that I used when I started collecting in earnest maybe 15 years ago was on stuff that I liked, I purposely jumped back and started buying the older stuff first, especially older stuff that was still relatively low price, with the theory that that stuff was only going to go up, and it was actually a smart move do that. I mean, I'm back now, still getting old. So, I mean, I didn't go all the way back, right, on most stuff. But, you know, for instance, that Aparo Spectre stuff from Adventure, you can still get stuff in, like, you know, fine condition. I probably would imagine for, like, about $2-3 an issue. You know, 5-10 years from now, maybe something will happen that stuff will actually go up. you know.
Yeah, that's actually affecting a lot of the buying. That I was doing is that I was going back, and I was more mad when I missed out on something from 86 than I was something I missed out from 94, because I wanted to get those older ones so I knew a little bit more backstory and how things built.
Part of it for me is there comes a point where if I go too far back, the storytelling style is just enough different that it doesn't quite work for me, you know? So there's kind of a dividing point somewhere in the 70s where, you know, things after that, I'm really happy with things before that and maybe not so much. And it varies from title to title. But I totally see your point about getting the earlier stuff, you know, while it's in the more affordable price range. It totally makes sense.
Yeah, I expect next year to push back the JLA I'm collecting. I'm hoping to push it back through pretty much through 72, maybe even 1970, and maybe Action back that far. But I doubt it, because...
Now, on Elementals, I'm filling in some major gaps. So with Volume 2, I picked up issues 1 through 3, 5, 10 through 13, 16 through 18, and 20 through 25... I also picked up Elementals How the War Was Won number 2 and Elementals Vampire's Revenge 1 and 2. I've got a few other things on order, and then I got to kind of take stock, figure out what I've got left before I kind of have all of it. And some of that was the Bill Willingham stuff, some of that was not, but I'm looking forward to that. And let's see, I had this really weird gap in the Flash for the first series from 266 to 274. That I somehow managed to do. For some reason, I skipped those at one point, so I went and got those. Picked up some stuff out of the Milestone line. I had one issue of Cobalt, and it was like 99 cents a shot or whatever over at Torpedo Comics, so I picked up 1 through 6 and 8 through 16, giving me a complete run of that. And at some point, I'll figure out what other Milestone stuff I do and don't have, and see if there are other gaps I need to kind of fill in on that line. Because I'm interested in the characters, particularly now they may be getting somewhat integrated with the DC Universe in some way, shape, or form. Picked up...
That was the Static Shock stuff, right?
It was Static, it was Icon, it was Hardware, there was a whole line of it.
Okay, I couldn't remember who the big one out of that was, but yeah.
Static, I think, was the breakout hit, no question about that. I would say Icon was probably the next most popular title or most memorable title, but more for the Rocket sidekick than for the main hero. Flipping over to Marvel, I picked up a bunch of stuff from there, and part of it was they had an M through Z sale on, so it's like, okay, let's see what they've got. Picked up issues 31 through 33 of Marvel's Spotlight. One of them was a Nick Fury one. I forget who was in the other two. It may have been him, and I think one of them was Spider-Woman and whatnot, but it looked like fun stuff. Picked up a bunch of Marvel team-up. My run of that started at 141 and went through the end of the series at 150, so I only had a few issues. Because, again, I didn't hop on to most of Marvel until after Secret Wars. So I pushed this more or less back to issue 80 with a couple of gaps because they didn't have the issues. So I got 80 through 90, 92, 93, 95, 96, 98... 100 through 104, 106 through 140.
What years would those be, roughly? 78, 79?
That would go... I'm not sure when issue 80 of that came out. But, again, mid-70s to early 80s.
Okay.
Picked up Marvel 2-in-1, number 27. And off the top of my head, I don't remember why I put that one in. That may have either been to fill in a gap or because it had some character that I... wanted to get. Picked up what I believe to possibly be the last Power Ranger comic I may need, which was Mighty Morphin Power Rangers the Movie number 1, just to finish off that whole run. I'm really liking the Iron Fist stuff these days. That was enough to get me to pick up a lot of the Power Man and Iron Fist series. Prior to that, I had issue 121, which was the Secret Wars 2 crossover, and I pushed that more or less back, again, certain issues they didn't have, so I didn't get, to issue 51, where Iron Fist came in. So I got 51, 53, 54, 56, 58 through 62, 64 through 70, 72 through 87, 89 to 96, 98 to 103, 106 to 120, and then 122 to 125 where the series ended. So I still got a couple of gaps in there to go fill in at some point. So I've been kind of building up my want list on mycomicshop.com. Hopefully some of those will hit and I'll be able to pick those up. Now, as a related thing to that, and I think the Marvel team-up, or maybe it was the Marvel 2-in-1, I picked up ROM 23 and 24, which was second parts to stories I was getting the first part of in one of these other comics. Because I have no real attachment to the ROM character or comic. But, you know, I figured, well, if it's continuing a story, I may as well pick that up. I also picked up the Volume 3 trade paperback of Raider. I would have picked up the other two if I could find them, but I haven't done that yet. That was a comic done by Tom Zoller, who does Love and Capes, which I'm really enjoying. He had talked about that when we talked with him on a recent preview spotlight interview episode. And so I figured, yeah, let's check out his other work. He does good stuff. Another title I pushed fairly far back was Spectacular Spider-Man, the original series. I got from 32 to 63 and 65 to 89, and my run of that off the rack originally picked up with issue 90. And that, well, that and the Marvel team-up pretty much was when he got the black costume originally, which is what got me onto the Spider-Man titles. I also got Thanos 7 through 12, figure, hey, it's on a discount, let's finish off that run, because I had the first six. Also picked up What If from the first volume, numbers 20 and 38. And off the top of my head, I don't remember what was in there and what prompted that, but, you know, they seemed cool. And that's not a filling in gaps kind of a thing, because I've got major gaps on that title. At some point, I'll probably finish off the original run. I've got the whole second run of it. And then the other one that I picked up a ton of issues of was Thieves and Kings, after talking with Mark Oakley on a recent previews spotlight interview episode. I picked up 1 through 45, and at least issue 46 to get if I can find it. So I did all of this in the span of three orders, two with mycomicshop.com, one with Torpedo Comics, and one of them with my comic shop, the first that really kicked all this off, was like 236 comics or so. So I bought a total of 288 comics, averaging at about $1.93 a piece, which puts it more or less in line with what I'm paying for new comics. Now, one thing I do want to mention about Torpedo Comics, I haven't done many purchases with them. This is maybe my second or third. One of the things that I don't recall them doing before, but I really like with their packing list, is they have cover images on it. So not only do you have the title and the issue and the price, but again, a cover scan where you can say, oh, that's what it is. Now, that having been said, I got 17 comics from them, and it was pretty much a two-page packing list. If I had gotten the 236 issues I'd got from my comic shop and they did this kind of a printout, it would be a gargantuan packing list. So just keep that in mind.
I was going to say, their printing costs must be, people get
astronomical.
Well, and the funny thing is, everything I got from, not everything, most of what I got from Torpedo was out of their monolith section, so it was 99 cents. Some of the elemental stuff I actually paid like $2 or $3 for, just because they had it, my comic shop didn't. But, you know, if you're looking for stuff, and particularly for you, John, you're getting the stuff in the 90s and more recent and whatnot, check out Torpedo, go through the monolith if you need to fill in some gaps. Because
I have
99 cents, how can you go wrong?
I have. I'm just, right now I'm at the point of I want to consolidate, know what I have, and that way I can go back. I've got to sit down and spend a day basically scanning in my, borrowing the barcode scanner from work, buying a program like whichever, I can't remember the one you told me about, Bob, and just sit down and do it. I got to know what I have because I don't want to keep, because I know I've bought a couple of things twice. I mean, what we're going to talk about with the Longbow Hunters, I bought another copy Friday because I didn't want to have to dive into my books to find it. I mean, I only paid $6 for it, but I mean, for all three, but I did not want to have to go back and try and find them. And
yeah, look on our forum there's some various people who feel pretty strongly one way or another about the different comics software systems. Comic Base, which is what I use, is not cheap. There are other ones that are much cheaper, and I don't know what functionality is in the cheaper ones. I would find it hard to believe that they're as robust as the more expensive one, but I don't know because I don't use them. And again, another issue is how efficient is the database underlying. You know, I know that Comic Base has got a really robust database, and you know, I got like 40,000 plus comics in it now, right? And it works just fine. You know, is something else that's using a, you know, kind of less industrial strength database as its back end. You know, someone who's got 5,000 or 6,000 comics, they're not necessarily going to notice any difference one way or the other. But if they go much more, you know, if they get up there, is it going to fall apart? You know, and another one you can use just online. I mean, Comic Book DB has a capability to keep your collection in that. You don't have to buy anything. But again, you know, it's like I wouldn't want to enter 40 some odd thousand comics into Comic Book DB, you know, even though you can enter runs all at once. It's still not,
well, I mean, not the, even the
industrial strength,
even entering runs and stuff. I've got titles, or I've got like over 4,000 different titles in my collection easily. So even if I could enter all the runs individually, I'd have to go, okay, Action Comics, enter that in, go through that process, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 times. That just takes a while.
Well, what really is the more applicable is once you have it entered the first time, right, how do you keep the collection current?
Yeah.
So if in a given week you get 50 comic books, John,
mm-hmm.
Or let's say you even get 20. If you have to go in and go to individually to 20 different titles to enter those, that's kind of a hassle. Whereas all new comics pretty much have the barcode. And again, I got the barcode scanner, and now it's just like boop, 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 boop. It takes, you know, literally a minute to enter those 20 comics using Comic Base.
I totally agree that the barcode scanner is much preferable to keying in the data. However, you know, my collection is downstairs. My reading room is downstairs. My computer I would be doing this on is upstairs. And frankly, some of this I'm doing during my lunch hour at work. So, you know, in many cases when I'm inventorying my comics, they're nowhere within arm's reach, sometimes not within, you know, 20-mile radius of the computer I'm at.
You got your choice of, do you want to key them in individually while you're sitting at work and spend 15 minutes, or do you want to carry them upstairs and spend 30 seconds and then carry them back downstairs? I mean,
well, I want something where I have a checkoff list and I can just compare it to the packing list and be done with it.
Well, that's a wireless scanner, John.
Yeah, but again, you know, I remember going to the store where they would, you know, use, I think, ComTrack for their point of sale system. And they'd have to do the barcode scan on everything. And it took them, you know, 10 minutes sometimes to ring me up. So I'm not going to say that it would be that slow or whatever with a comic-based thing. I would just, for me personally, I like to manage my collection at the point of when I order it, when it arrives. And at the when it arrives point, only have to be, you know, checking off items on a list. But, you know, I haven't fully investigated, you know, comic-based or some of these others to know if they would do what I want or not. But everyone has different needs, and I think the size of the collection, like you were pointing out, Bob, plays a factor in that, you know, both in terms of, you know, entering in 40,000 plus comics, entering in however many you get per week. It's one thing if you get, you know, a half dozen. It's another thing if you get, you know, a few dozen. So
one other thing to consider is, Bob, I mean, how many comics did you have before you started using Comic Book, before you using the program you use?
40-some thousand. I mean, they're not all in it yet.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, for me, who's starting probably right around the 4,000 or 5,000 range, I need something that will grow with me and still be stable. Right.
Well, and for you, since most of your stuff is newer, they're going to have all the barcodes. So doing something that can scan all that in to where you just take it out of the box, scan it, put it back in, that does make a lot of sense.
I mean, it's really slow. I mean, that's we're through most of that now, right? It's like it's really slow to enter things in individually. Well, plus when you're buying back issues, they're all different grades. I mean, you can't, you know, if you want to actually track what you accurately have, you know, you're not just checking off on a list. You're not just saying, okay, I got all these. And so I get a stack of, you know, comics that were in my collection. They weren't all in the same condition necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, these are in fine. These are very fine. These are near mint. These are good, you know, very good. You know, I don't really have that many that are good. You know, but you have to look at them, and it also depends on how well you track that stuff. I had a whole bunch of old comics from, you know, back when I was early collecting that were just in bags and they weren't graded. So then, okay, you pull out a long box and it's full of comics and they're all old comics. They're not all in perfect condition. So now you got to pull those all out. You got to look at them. You have to grade them, you know. Take a Sharpie and put the grade on the bag, actually, you know, so that you know it for future. But, you know, then you have to enter that in, and it makes it kind of it takes time, you know. So it's one thing if you just want to have a knowledge of I have this regardless or I don't, you know. It's another if you want to accurately understand what your collection is, what are the condition of everything in the collection, you know, what are, you know, other kinds of things. So
yeah, I agree with that entirely. And that's something that, you know, when you're picking a program, you want to factor in. Does it do the level of support you want on the conditions, on the location of the comics, on the pricing and value? You know, do you want one that keeps a history of that? Do you want it to track what you bought it for? That kind of stuff. So
Longbow Hunters, the reason we have all come together here today.
Yes. This was good stuff. You know, one of the things I want to kind of start the discussion off with before we get too much into the particular issues, it had been probably since this came out that I read it, so 20-so years. And I remember liking it, I remember thinking it was great. Certainly Mike Grell is one of the names I associate with Green Arrow. And what I found particularly interesting about this was at that point in time, the pendulum for this character at least was swinging very much into the realism and realistic grim and not grim and gritty, but more grounded era for the character. A lot of what they do in this series is kind of, you know, get him away from the boxing glove arrow and stuff like that. And get him towards just, you know, he's a straight archer, he's more grounded, and really, in the backstory, it goes from, you know, what it had been, whatever that was, in terms of, you know, what did he really do on the island, what really happened, to more of a, maybe he got drunk, maybe he fell overboard, scared off a few guys who were stoned, and then became Green Arrow because it just seemed like the fun thing to do, or what have you, versus him actually having a really heroic origin. And compare that to where we are now. You know, artistically, the look of Green Arrow Black Canary is, I don't want to say cartoony because it's not, but it's a brighter color, simplified art in an almost animated style in a certain degree compared to, you know, this gorgeous Grell stuff we've got. And both are great art and fit the character, but also very, very different. And it just, you know, reading through this the other day really brought home how strong the core concept for the character is and how much flexibility there is in that, to where you can do everything from the boxing glove arrow and, you know, kind of play it for laughs a little bit, do a little bit lighthearted stuff like they're doing now, like they had done, you know, before Longbow Hunters and stuff, and still be able to do a darker, grittier, more realistic version of the character and have that play exceedingly well, too. So it was kind of interesting to see how that pendulum has swung back and forth over the decades. So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of what Grill did with this actually even today in a character like Daredevil and Captain America. I mean, one thing that everybody has complained is that they're not involved in the Secret Invasion storyline at all in their main titles because they're telling their own story their own way, and Grill actively prohibited Green Arrow really from being involved when he wrote the series and drew the series from being involved in DC proper. I mean, as was pointed out in a Wikipedia article, Hal Jordan popped in a couple times as Hal Jordan, not Green Lantern. I mean, the only real superhero that popped in was Warlord.
Yeah, but it would have broken the mood, the tone, the style of the series for some guy to literally come flying in with an alien power ring.
And also, if I think I remember correctly, Ollie aged in real time in the series because he's 43 at the time the series started, which puts him a little bit ahead of the age of a lot of his fellow superheroes at the time, because, I mean, that really kind of kept his age pre-crisis, and it was post-crisis, because if they had restarted everything post-crisis, he should have de-aged about 10, 12 years.
Yeah. Well, again, to me, that goes towards a level of realism and sometimes a subtle level at that, where he acts in a more natural manner. He's, again, like you said, he was aging. He's not this brightly colored, you know, ageless, superheroic character. He's just a guy trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, this art style was kind of the, I'm not sure if it was the first, but it was kind of like that next level of Grell's artistic evolution. You know, he had started with the more standard comic book art. And I mean, he did Warlord, obviously. He did Green Arrow, Green Lantern. He picked that book up after the hiatus that happened after the Neil Adams run. That was when I first got into DC, was right around that time. In fact, the first three books that I loved at DC were all by Mike Grell. The first three things that I really was into was Green Lantern, Green Arrow, back in the 90s, you know, of issue 90 range, when Grell was doing the Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Warlord, and Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah.
That Grell was doing all of those, and that's really what pulled me into DC and what initially made me a hardcore DC fan and got me into the DC universe. And Grell's art here, it's really him taking it to the next level. And what you see starting in this series is really the art style that he took forward, and you'd see places like Star Slayer over at First Comics and John Sable Freelance also over at First Comics. It's just the kind of fine line pencil rendering that you see here. You know, the heavy ink lines delineating things, and the crosshatch shading, and even, you know, in some places you see kind of the where he does the sort of drawing with the black background with the white almost kind of pastel markings. You know, he has those for emphasis at various places in here. Just it really looks like art. I don't know a bad way to say it, but it's like it's art as opposed to comic book art.
No, I agree with you entirely. There are a couple of places where, you know, I'm not art savvy enough to know exactly what he's using for this, what style and what tools, but there are a couple where, you know, you get the comic book type art in a very realistic style, and then you get, like on page 27 of the first issue, this one shot of Black Canary that has a level of like photorealism in a black and white manner that is just amazing. And stylistically, it's different than the other panels on the page, which yet fits perfectly too, because it emphasizes that panel and what she's saying. And it's, I mean, some of the art here is just amazing in the quality, in the style, in the nature of it. you know, everything from the page layouts, each individual panel. I mean, this, I think, is some of Grell's best stuff, and none of his stuff is bad.
This, in general, is a masterpiece, in my opinion. This is about as good as it gets. You know, this I would hold up against any other, you know, people talk about Kingdom Come, and they talk about Watchmen, and, you know, Bendis run on Daredevil, you know, and you can, in my opinion, lay this Longbow Hunters down next to any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the same kind of a story. Doesn't have the same, you know, sweeping context of a Kingdom Come or something like that, but it's got fabulous storytelling. We're kind of if we want to stay with the general mode, without spoilers particularly, and then we can dive into a more detailed analysis of the three issue series. But I mean, I would say that anyone, even if you don't like Green Arrow now, you know, if you like characters like Daredevil now, you know, the street level urban kind of Daredevil, if you like like that, Iron Fist, you know, this is a precursor to that stuff. This would be something to check out.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely.
No handcuff arrows and boxing glove arrows and things like that. Oh, I like Green Arrow when he did that kind of stuff also. I mean, there was a certain exuberance to that version of Green Arrow. But this version is really taking Green Arrow and grounding him in reality to some extent. I mean, it's like basically if you take a hero, I mean, you take the Green Arrow character in general, he's a guy who goes around with bow and arrow fighting crime. And the Green Arrow that is portrayed in this series, you could really have this happen in the real world. I mean, he's not doing anything crazy. He doesn't have, you know, again, these arrows that, like, you know, how would a boxing glove arrow actually really aerodynamically fly? Well, he doesn't use any of those arrows. You know, it's like even Daredevil. I mean, he's swinging around with a, you know, his billy club and having radar senses and stuff. Well, you know, or even Batman, you know, he's like, you know, same kind of thing with these, all the gadgets and things like that. You know, it's like, well, sort of Batman could really exist, but maybe sort of not. This Green Arrow, I could see anything that happened in here could really happen.
Yeah, because, I mean, people know how to shoot arrows. Arrows can do damage. You know, there's nothing in here that is outrageous or unbelievable or anything of that sort. And they did a really good job, you know, making this a very believable series in that regard.
So, John Carroll, you love Green Arrow, so yeah. Lay it on us. I mean, what do you think here?
I mean, it's kind of funny. I got into liking Green Arrow because I liked Birds of Prey and Black Canary. And really, and I wanted to know more about, because they kept mentioning Ollie, and then I got into the Kevin Smith run, and so I pushed in after the Kevin Smith run. I jumped in, I read Longbow Hunters, and I was like, okay, this is similar to me to The Dark Knight Returns, but I actually like it better because the art, to me, is better than Dark Knight. And was, and it's realistic as hell. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, as you said, I mean, the art is gorgeous. You have to get used to Dinah being a brunette in this again, and really, my only complaint I ever had was that in every other comic, she's more white. I mean, this sounds really bad, but he's really got the shading on her to where she looks not much more ethnic than she normally does. I mean, that's just a complaint I have about it, because I guess it's because of the way she's drawn later. But I mean, even Ollie, when you look at this, I mean, he's not hugely muscled, neither is Black Canary. I mean, so I mean, look at, you're going, these are people that I could realistically see in their outfits and doing what they're doing and acting the way they're acting. And by putting it in Seattle, I mean, they really make the city a part of the story. The city is as much a part of the city as they are. And the story that's in this story is it's very 1980s, where the people reading it can go, okay, which we'll get into in a minute. I mean, that's something I can believe because these guys are right at the edge of that time.
Yeah, I think you've got a really good point on a lot of that, particularly the body styles and stuff for, like, Green Arrow. he almost comes across as a little bit skinny in a few places versus, again, a heavily muscled, you know, standard superheroic physique. And I also think that moving him to Seattle and putting him off in essentially a distant corner of the DC universe was a smart move and worked very well.
I really like the realistic city. And I mean, I've been to Seattle a number of times. I go up there every 4 to 6 weeks. And I mean, I've been on some of the streets that he draws in here. It's exactly what it looks like. I mean, he had to have, you know, he's either been there, or used photo reference or whatever, but...
One thing that I can say that I did like about this, especially when we get into it, is on pages 32 through 34, when he's confronting the street punks, he doesn't draw them bad, as in he's not making them he's not drawing them over the top, whereas they're really being the perception that a lot of people had. He's drawing them as they were, the characters with the street punks with the mohawk, tattoos and everything. He's drawing them realistic. He's not drawing them over top like the way you get in a lot of comics and the way you get in a lot of movies where they're really drawn over the top. They're drawn very realistic, like these are street punks and kids that I can see as I walk down the street in the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
You get the idea, okay, these are people that I could see day in, day to day, walking around.
Well, they're not stereotypical, you know, cliche versions of what a street punk would look like. You know, they fit the mold or whatever, but in a believable manner. Whereas you look at, like, in the Detroit era, the Justice League, when they would, you know, get hassled with the gangs and whatnot. You know, some of that was just, you've got to be kidding me.
The language is also, I mean, the word choice is very realistic. I mean, I don't know if Grell lived in Seattle at the time, but I mean, he probably lived in, I think he's from that area.
Yeah, it's very Pacific Northwest-y feel. I mean, even that one, it's like almost an oil painting in the third issue, you know, on page 20 and 21, the kind of two-page across the bottom where he's got the Mount Rainier with the lake and the forest and stuff. It's like, wow. You know.
Well, actually, you know, going to the art and stuff and the realism, one of the pages I really liked was in the first issue, and it was page 12, where, you know, Ollie gives Dinah the tour of their new place, you know, above the florist shop. And it's a simple page. You get a couple of shots of a couple of rooms or whatever, but he's saying, okay, this is their headquarters, this is where they live, and by firmly establishing kind of the layout of the place, which he then went on to use in the ongoing series, it gave it a level of realism. You know, they go up the stairs, they're going to hit this, they go down the stairs, they hit this, and it's always that way. You know, it's a subtle touch, it's a simple thing, but something that a lot of creators and stuff never do. You know, I mean, you read this stuff, you know the layout of where they live. Can you really say that about, you know, your average, you know, superhero or comic book character? And to me, that just, again, goes down towards he's taking this seriously. He's trying to make the story as believable as possible, in some ways, in very, you know, obvious manners, by grounding it in a real city that looks realistic, by, you know, kind of showing us the sights and stuff, in other ways, just by the nature of the storytelling. You know, and where he takes the time to, you know, go into the police station, it feels like a real one. These seem like real people. You know, it's...
Yeah, and I guess what I'm a... You know, I visit Seattle, right? So I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived in Seattle, so I don't know how realistic this feels to someone who lives in Seattle. But I guess all I can say is that it captures the essence of Seattle, because I just, having been there, you know, 20 times or something, it just, to me, feels like the feeling I get when I go there. You know what I mean? Especially even like you look at the cityscape that's on the back of issue number one. I mean, that kind of captures, you know, you got, you know, your Space Needle in there. You got Mount Rainier in the background. You kind of got the city. You got the stadium there.
Yeah.
He currently does live in Washington State. Yeah. He's not from there, but he lives there now.
And I like that choice. Again, it brings it to that realism where, you know, they took it out of Star City, which is, you know, the fictitious DC City where Green Arrow historically operated out of, and they put him into a real world city, which is different, again, than a lot of DC characters. You know, the DC even today has very little activity in real cities. In the real, you know, our cities. I mean, you have a little bit in New York.
Maybe some in L.A., but beyond that, I'd be hard-pressed to name any.
Coast City and Star City and Metropolis and Gotham and, you know, Central City and Keystone and all the other D.C. cities. This, at the time and even today, you know, putting this in Seattle was a huge departure from the D.C. status quo.
And of course, in the contrast, of course, you contrast that with Marvel's everybody's in New York. We're not, you know, in DC, they're like, okay, these are fictional cities, so we can make up stuff about them and have them be things and do things that a normal city cannot do. Whereas when, that's why putting them in a realistic city like Seattle was such a departure for DC, because before, when you had cities like Opal City from Starman, which doesn't look like any city that you've ever seen, I mean, it can look like parts of it. I mean, and then you've got Hub City, like you mentioned, and Gotham and Metropolis. And having cities in fictional places, you can have these unusual, beautiful cities or dark and depressing cities that don't look like anything you can know. And it also doesn't make it seem like, to me, it's also a way of saying, oh, your city's horrible. I mean, let's say instead of it being Metropolis, it was New York. Or instead of Gotham, it was Providence, Rhode Island, or something like that. To the people of Providence, people can go, oh, you live in where Batman lives. Oh, God, your city's horrible. And it's making them seem more fictional, which, of course, plays into the whole DC gods versus the street thing. But
Yeah, but, I mean, even, you know, across both DC and Marvel, aside from Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Detroit, can you name off the top of your head any character that has been headquartered anywhere in a real city?
Other than Damage temporarily before he got kicked out of Georgia?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's so few and far between, you actually got to stop and think. It's like, wait a sec, where was this guy again? No, he never really, you know. So for a real city to act as a very real backdrop, both for this miniseries and, again, for the status quo for the Green Arrow character for quite some time, was a huge major departure both then and now. I'm curious if he had any problems convincing DC Editorial to let him do that. It was a good move to do.
You don't know, because, I mean, it was the late 80s, so the realistic comic trend was starting to hit, and also, it's Green Arrow. I mean, let's be honest, I mean, at the time, yeah, he was a moderately low B-lister, almost C-level. I mean, he wasn't a big character, so they probably told him, sure, you want to do it with this character that nobody really cares about. Sure, go ahead.
But even then, I mean, you look at it, it's like he moved Green Arrow to Seattle. I mean, it's like, it's not like lots of other DC characters were getting, you know, he did stand out even then. I mean, the realism trend, as far as it went, it was pretty much started and stopped here with Green Arrow.
But also, how many other non-superheroes does DC have other than Green Arrow and Batman? About everybody else has a metagene or has a technological power of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, other than, I guess you got the whole Batman family of people, but outside of that. You're right.
And one of those is now centered in a realistic city with Nightwing moving to New York.
Yeah, give him a few issues, he'll move out. But, I mean, was there really this huge realistic movement going on at DC or not? Because concurrent, you know, with this in 1987, you know, give or take a few months, I don't remember exactly which months these shipped, this is when we saw the birth of the Bwahaha Justice League. You know, which featured Black Canary. And that was about as far from realistic as you can get. So, you know, this was a departure, I think. I don't think it really was either the start or part of a huge realism movement at DC.
I was thinking more of a reaction to Dark Knight, and not even maybe DC proper, but maybe this was starting the foundation of what would eventually become some Vertigo stuff, because didn't Swamp Thing come out also around this time?
I think it'd been going for a couple of years, but that's a good point. There was that movement within DC to
do... For the mature artists.
Yeah.
Mature audience. Yeah, I mean, that's what a lot of things... Because this is a mature audience title, and was when it was out.
Yeah, and this does have leanings in terms of tone and style towards what would become the Vertigo line. Certainly, I don't think this ever would have classified as a Vertigo title, but... Much more so than, again, the Blahaha Justice League with Giffen DeMatteis and what have you.
Wasn't, but Legion was also dark. It started to become a lot darker at this time, with 5 years later when the ongoing was going on. Batman got a little darker with Long Halloween. Superman was, of course, still Superman. But even Green Lantern turned a little dark during this time. I mean, you've got other stuff other than just Justice League that are turning a little darker or getting a little bit more different in tone than what they were before.
Well, around this point with Green Lantern, that's when they had the Green Lantern Corps based on Earth, I believe. So they were still doing a lot of standard superheroics. Now, certainly not a lot of it, you know, the light and funny stuff like Justice League. That was certainly a unique in and of itself in many respects. But
what was Marvel really doing at this time?
This would have been around the time of the New Universe. This would have been around the time of I'm trying to think what else would have been.
Yeah, so I'll just pull up Comic Book DB really quick. One of the useful things about Comic Book DB is you look at the date, and then yeah, exactly, and then you just look at what other stuff was coming out at that exact same time.
I was looking at May 1987, but I need to find out when Longbow Hunters, what months those were. That was August, September, and October. So I'll go with September being the middle point, and let's go take a look at what else was coming out. We had Blue Beetle Booster Gold. We had Alpha Flight early on. Where does this...
So American Flag had already been out for a while at this point. So actually, you know, this... So I back to my previous statement. This was not the beginning of this style because he had been doing... Sable was up around issue 51. So he had pioneered this style that we see here with John Sable, Freelance. So to put that into time context, this was not the, unlike what I had maybe thought before, this was not the beginning of this. This was when he introduced this to the DC universe, but he had been doing John Sable Freelance for a while. In fact, he was probably off John Sable by this point. He was writing it, but he wasn't drawing it anymore.
And this was before... I believe the Hawk World stuff, where Hawkman went into a kind of a darker, moodier tone.
Yeah. So New Universe was going. We've got DP7 is up on issue 11 here. Let's go down to S. We got Star Brand is on issue 9.
And this was a ways before
Suicide Squad's going on.
I think this was before the 5 year later stuff with Legion.
I mean, it's not also as much as stuff that was ongoing at the same time, but stuff that would come out shortly afterwards, that this would also be... I'm not saying that it would inspire and also influence.
No, I think you've got a very valid point there, that based on the reaction to this, the success of both this and the series that followed, I think that set the scene to allow things like Hawk World for Hawkman, for some of the other things that started to get a bit more either realistic or, I don't want to use the term mature, but sophisticated, I think would be the way to go, to where they realize they don't have to just have the boxing glove arrow equivalent for various heroes. They can take a more serious approach. They can do more grounded stories, even if the characters themselves aren't necessarily grounded. Certainly, the Hawkworld stuff, you know, alien setting, you know, sci-fi type stuff, but a less cookie-cutter, you know, sugar-coated version of it.
I just realized Long Halloween came out 10 years after this. I apologize for that.
This was right around the time of Dark Knight, though. Dark Knight came out in, what, 84? Yeah. So it was a couple of years after that. But, I mean, if you look at some of the other stuff that was coming out in this time, this was right around – this was actually a few years after the really huge renaissance of independent, more independent, let's say, type of things, because I mean, I'm looking around. I mean, you got First Comics is going full steam.
Mm-hmm.
Kamiko is going on. We've got Evangeline coming out. We've got Elementals coming out.
Justice Machine, yeah.
Justice Machine is coming out.
That's actually what I was more aiming at, was stuff that was going on in the independent world, not necessarily in DC proper, but I mean, that's what makes this so different, that it is a independent feeling title.
Yeah, Nexus has been going on for a couple of years at this point, but I mean, there's some tremendous independent stuff that was coming out in 1987 that, you know, I think is that, boy, there was years there, like from about 1983-84 through the end of the 80s, that there was just a lot of really good stuff coming out.
Well, I would say the things at DC that kind of are in this general style, although certainly not to this degree of realism and groundedness, Question. New Teen Titans, to a lesser degree, was a bit more of a realistic look at that kind of a super team.
Well, they tried that with Wild Dog, that number one came out the same month as Longbow Hunters number two.
Between the art style and some of the stuff, I'm not sure if I'd say that.
I'm not talking about the art style. I'm talking about they tried to make a realistic character. This is just a guy who puts on a hockey mask and picks up a gun and goes out and, like, fights. You know,
that had pretty over-the-top action, though. I would say that was, I don't know, I could go either way. I was going to go with Wonder Woman, though, because they were trying to ground that more into the mythology. And again, a more serious take on it. So there are other things that, you know, fall into this general direction of, I guess the best way to put it, comics aren't just for kids, but they're not just for adults either. So
I didn't find Wild the Dog to be particularly over the top. You don't know what over the top is if you think Wild Dog was over the top.
Well, I also haven't read it for 20 years, so.
Go read Hitman by Warren Ellis if you want to see over the top. Wild Dog was not over the top.
I think, though, for its...
Wild Dog was the Punisher in the DC universe, you know?
I mean, even in some titles, you also had coming out at the same time that were based on cartoons. Kids' cartoons were actually kind of dark. G.I. Joe, Transformers, both of those had lots of violence and lots of... kind of mature, not really mature storylines, but they also had death and everything that this book has. I mean, and really, outside in the DCU proper, I mean, how many real deaths or killings did you really have?
Where does this line up with the Batman titles in terms of what happened with Jason Todd?
Which Jason Todd? Are you talking Jason Todd, Red Hood, or Jason Todd, Jason Todd?
Jason Todd. Where does it line up with him getting Robin?
This is a bit before.
I think this was after they had revamped him to be the guy who stole the tires off the Batmobile, but a bit before they killed him off. All right.
Because pre-Crisis, he was basically just a clone of Grayson, and this one, it's a little different.
I mean, there were still some definitely brightly colored corners of the DC universe showing up at this point.
Yeah, so the Batman that came out this month, it's definitely had the pre-Crisis Jason Todd. He's running around in the little green shorts and pixie boots, and they're fighting Two-Face, who's robbing a casino.
So, I mean, you take a look just at the cover of that Batman and compare it to, again, the covers of these Green Arrow Longbow Hunters, and, man, huge stylistic difference there, which is cool. I mean, it's nice to see DC both then and now, you know, kind of trying to hit all edges of the spectrum when they can, and not just saying, well, this one thing works, let's put all our titles in that direction.
Year one had just ended, by the way, right before this came out.
I mean, I would say that this was a really good time in comics. It would be another, you know, 5 to 10 years before you hit that point in the 90s where most people seem to bail out. And certainly, I think, you know, things like Grell's work on Green Arrow was some of the highlights of this.
Okay, you want to dive into a spoilerific analysis of the series?
Sure. With the first issue, basically we get introduced to Seattle. We find out there's a series of killings going on, targeting, you know, prostitutes and other people like that. We also find out that Green Arrow and Black Canary, or more accurately, Ollie Queen and Dinah Lance, have moved to Seattle. She's opening up a florist shop, which really we hear about, but I don't think we ever actually see any flowers in it. The best we see is somebody getting thrown through the front window and, you know, it being related to drugs, which Diana decides to, you know, go investigate. I love the name Sherwood Florist, by the way, for the name of the florist shop. And, you know, again, I like how we get the location, the home above it set up, and how so much of this is about the relationship between Ollie and Dinah. We get a recap of his origin, and it was nice how he paid homage or whatever to the way it had been told before, and essentially Ollie kind of debunking it, saying, well, yeah, they made me out to be this big hero, but really it was a lot more simple than that. I got drunk, I fell overboard, I wound up on the island. You know, I used the bow and arrow to, you know, shoot game, and gosh, that took a while to learn how to do that. And then, you know, the drug runners show up, stoned out of their mind, checking on, you know, their marijuana crop, and, you know, he makes it back. He's made out to be this big hero, and he's like, you know, that sounds like fun, let's do that. And then, you know, covering also the realistic era that came before this.
Just to go into that, though, just a little bit, is I like how he ties in Howard Hill, who is a real guy, who did teach Errol Flynn archery, you know, for Robin Hood, and that he was on a yacht and he was like, you know, kind of looking at the archery stuff. So that, I mean, it put some kind of context into, you know, why he would have gone with a bow and arrow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you look like even like the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, you know, he's on an island. It doesn't occur to him to make a bow and arrow. I mean, you get a stick and you, you know, spear a fish with it or something. You don't necessarily cobble together a bow and arrow on an island.
Well, kind of tying into that, Grell is a big game hunter as well. So, I mean, that's a little bit of his own history into that as well.
Yeah. And like you said, tying in the flair for the style and why going for a Robin Hood looking motif appealed to him. So, and it also, you know, made it a natural flow as to why we get this kind of, you know, couple of pages of exposition, and how it also not only tells us the backstory, but gives us some insight into Ollie's character, you know, as to how he's telling it, why he's telling it, and what he's debunking. You know, we actually get a panel here where we get, I think, the bolo arrow or whatever in use, which I think is the sole example of a trick arrow in the whole thing, and how he makes, you know, allusions to, or more accurately, illustrations to, Arsenal or Speedy or Roy Harper, whatever name you want to give him, with the current Red Arrow, his drug problems, and that realistic era, and, you know, how he lost his fortune, that kind of stuff. But really, he kind of glosses over that pretty quick, which is a little surprising. And then we get into, you know, again, more of the serial killing going on for a couple of pages. A lot more about the relationship between, you know, Ollie and Dinah, you know, complete with him asking Dinah to marry him. And, you know, her basically saying, no, not now, and how she doesn't want to have kids, and how that, you know, puts a little bit of a strain on the relationship and whatnot. And, you know, we've got, again, a bit of the back to basics for Green Arrow having set up a little archery range in the basement. We actually see a boxing glove arrow, but how, you know, she, Dinah, you know, gives him the new costume before going off to, you know, look into the drug stuff. We see the scene that you had mentioned earlier, John, about the street punks and how he handles that in a very straightforward, realistic, you know, manner. With the only thing being unusual being, you know, he's in a costume with a bow and an arrow. But it's all played straight, it's played realistic. And I really love the bit when we get some of the stuff with the cops having, you know, talk to the witnesses and getting the different takes on, you know, well, who did this? Because, again, Green Arrow is new to Seattle. And you get the one panel with kind of the demonic-looking Green Arrow thing of, you know, he was this larger-than-life thing. And then another where you get the Errol Flynn Robin Hood and, you know, how people describe him as that. And that was fun. We see a bit more with Green Arrow doing some investigative stuff, you know, finding the guy who winds up setting fire to the house. And, you know, again, this is played as Green Arrow, the older guy who's not in prime physical condition, which was fun. And then we start to get some stuff about how the we got some people kind of behind the scenes arranging some of the evil doing. And then we see a really nice two-page thing with Shadow in the background as somebody's on the phone talking to the guy kind of behind the scenes. And she gets introduced into the story. There's another killing going on that Ollie is about to stop, but, you know, Shadow kills the guy. Because, again, at this point, Green Arrow had accidentally killed somebody and was trying to not do that, I believe. Am I correct on that?
I believe he had accidentally, because it does mention that I think he had accidentally shot somebody and they died.
So he's, yeah, he's a little hesitant in some of those regards. And then Shadow kills the guy who was on the phone, who she's after, and he picks up his first clue of the Black Arrow, and, you know, that ends the first issue.
When you're reading this, I mean, it seems like it's going to be a typical find the serial killer, but then the serial killer is killed before the end of the first issue, until you find out it's something completely different as what the story arc will be.
Yeah. Well, and a lot happens in here, and now granted, it's, you know, 47 pages of art, but even beyond that, I think he packs a ton of story here, because we get a recap of the origin, and that's after we've, you know, set them up in Seattle. We get a couple of good action sequences, a lot of character moments. This is something that I think if they had split it in half, I don't think it would have worked as well. I think it needed to be this length.
I don't know. And, you know, it's also funny. I mean, we were talking about the price of this being $2.95. Do you realize there's absolutely zero ads in this book?
That was pretty standard for a prestige format at this point.
I'm unsure.
But like a regular comic book back then, you know, like the Batman that came out that month was 75 cents. So you put it in context that, you know, regular comics were 75 cents. So this being $3 was like four times what a regular comic book cost. So, you know, it'd be like a, you know, $10 or $12 graphic novel today.
That's a double sized issue, so I mean, it'd be more like an $8 comic, because this is a double issue.
Yeah, but even a double issue would only cost, you know, it's I'm saying it cost four times a comic off the regular racks. But it was on better paper. Yeah. It was square bound, you know.
But it sure felt expensive at the time.
Yeah, it was, you know, you look at it now, just to put it into context, you know, it's like, wow, it was only $2.95, you know, but again, I remember, I mean, that was like, wow, it was $2.95, you know, because again, it was four times what a regular comic cost.
Kind of funny, one thing I noticed, and I know it's kind of weird, but did you notice the cop, starting on page 23, the female cop? Her outfit, the top at least, looks scaringly like Speedy's outfit at that time, with the red and the yellow.
Oh, yeah. the current Speedy with the scarf thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also the old, and also Roy Harper, when he was Speedy, he used a similar looking outfit.
So if we move into the second issue, titled Dragon Hunt, this one focuses a little bit more on Shadow, and we start getting a little bit of what the Shadow character is all about. We get this opening montage in Japan. She's a kid. She's learning archery. You get the Yakuza things, and you're getting the first inklings of why these guys are getting killed. And you have this whole sequence going through, and then she kills yet another one of these old white guys who's, you know, has been involved in a meeting, and he goes walking out to his car, and boom, he takes the Black Arrow through the back of the neck. Yeah. And Green Arrow's now in the precinct. He's talking about these killings, the Robin Hood killer. In comes a policewoman, talks about another killing that's happened, and Green Arrow, of course, is, I suspect you'll find another one of these sticking out of him, and he holds up the Black Arrow. We move on and we're in the city again. Green Arrow's doing some investigation. He wants to find out what is going on here. He determines, actually, that it's suspicious for people of that age to have not been in the military, because a lot of people were in the military that were that age. It's his birthday. It's alluded to in the previous issue that his birthday was coming up, and Dinah gave him the present because she's going to be out investigating the drug trafficking. But, you know, here he is alone on his birthday. He's alone in the bed, very lonely image for him. And then he's out the next day and he's investigating again. He sees Dinah going into a bar. She sees him. Now, that's kind of an interesting car he's driving, but it looks like it's supposed to be the Sherwood Florist delivery truck. But usually you see a lot of realistic looking vehicles. I don't recall ever seeing cars driving around looking like that in the 80s, but it's certainly an interesting it looks almost like a PT Cruiser with running boards or something. It's
like a 30 Studebaker or Pontiac.
Yeah. Very interesting vehicle.
Definitely vintage or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. But it's nice because he's got the back, and then we realize kind of like, okay, it's the delivery vehicle, and it's kind of closed in the back, almost van-like, and he's able to change in the back, and out he comes in his uniform, and he's doing some investigation, and he comes upon Shadow, who's up on a rooftop, and she's got the bow out, and she's ready to do stuff. They have a bit of a conversation. You know, Green Arrow says, "I'm a little disappointed. It wasn't all that hard to find you." And she makes the statement back, "Finding me is one thing. Holding me is quite another." And, you know, they're kind of facing each other down. And she, although she has, I don't know what kind of arrowhead you call this, but she's got a different kind of arrowhead. I think it's called a frog catcher arrowhead. That she uses to cut the string on Ollie's bow. And what I find interesting about this is because you have the different kinds of arrowheads going on here. You got, you know, kind of the standard broadhead arrow, you know, hunting arrowheads and things like that. But this would be the kind of arrowhead that you would use if you wanted to catch and cut a bowstring, as opposed to, you know, you always see these people with just the little standard pointed arrowheads and stuff, and they're like, you know, cutting things and all this. It's like, well, that would be virtually impossible to do, you know. And this is much more realistic, that, you know, that you would shoot an arrowhead like this that you see here on page 27, and it would catch and cut that bowstring. And I think that's the realism also that Grell brings to this, because he's actually used a bow and he's actually done bow hunting and things like this. And he kind of knows a little bit about this stuff. So Shadow kills her next target. Smacks Green Arrow upside the head, and he gets knocked out. And, you know, next thing you know, he's back at Sherwood Florist, and he's soaking in the tub. And, you know, he's thinking to himself, whoever she is, she's good, damn good. You know, face it, old timer, you couldn't have made that shot. And he's kind of lamenting a little bit to himself, and he's back on the street again. This is really kind of an in-between issue. We're getting a lot of the pieces of the puzzle falling into place here. He's back. He's now tracking in, you know, Dinah's been missing for a while. He's looking into what happened to her. And she had been, you know, out. He saw her going into that bar. So he's back. He questions the guy at the bar. It leads him down to the docks. And he's down at the docks. He takes care of the guards. And then we cut to inside the warehouse, which is a drug lab, and the guys have the masks on. They're refining the cocaine, and then we see some bloody legs and a pool of blood on the ground. It's actually reflecting the image of the guy who's walking into the room, and we pan up, and we find that it is Dinah, and she's been beaten up pretty severely. She's got a swollen shut eye, and looks like she's taken a couple of blows to the face. She's got some cuts, and this guy is like, you know, essentially he's like some kind of psycho who gets off on, you know, doing bad stuff to women. and he's got the knife in his hand, and he's talking about how, you know, he wants her to talk. He can kill her quick, or he can make her last for a couple of hours. And he's got the knife there, and then next thing you know, he's got an arrow coming through him. And Green Arrow killed him. That's pretty much it. You know, he was going to kill Dinah, and Green Arrow, you know, he crossed the line here. You can understand why, but, you know, he wasn't messing around. You know, you do this kind of stuff, and then he charges in. Now, the next guy, he's not just going to kill everybody. You know, the next guy, he shoots through the knee, unfortunately. His gun goes awry a little bit, and he like hits some of the drug paraphernalia and gets showered with some flaming stuff and goes up in flames. The warehouse starts to burn. Ollie cuts Dinah down. He's getting her out of there, and now a guy comes out of the other room with a gun, takes a shot at them, misses. Before he can get too many more shots off, he takes an arrow into the eye, and we see that Shadow has appeared, and she essentially saves their life by putting this other guy down. Ollie gets Dinah out of the warehouse. The warehouse explodes, and that's where issue number 2 ends. Now, that was a very powerful issue. I remember when I read that, you know, you didn't see stuff like this happening in comics at all. I mean, it was...
Yeah, like you said, it's a very, very bloody issue.
Well, and nobody tended to get hurt there to the level that the Dinah was. I mean, it was good that they had set the scene in the previous issue of, hey, he's not a killer, he's trying not to do that. But then, you know, somebody threatens her, all bets are off. And it was a very powerful scene. What I'm trying to remember was, what was the status of her Canary Cry at this point?
I think this was the point that she lost it.
That's what I was thinking. But
lost it and the ability to have kids, allegedly, after this torture. But they've also stated she wasn't raped and she was never cut open. So you never really know exactly why she lost the ability to have kids. But the Canary Cry could have just been a psychological thing.
Yeah.
Or he could have just jabbed her in the throat and maybe done something. I don't know. This Canary Cry is a metagene ability. It's not a physical ability. Well, it's a metagene that she has.
Well, and she's able to tell Ollie, hey, sorry, I missed your birthday. So yeah. She could talk, but obviously, you know, she was in indefinite trouble.
Yeah.
So, John, do you want to bring us home with the third issue recap?
I'll let you all do it because you hit the points a lot better than I do.
Okay. So we start with a recap of... you know, what happened to Dinah in the previous issue, and the guy getting shot again, and, you know, it's very clearly a nightmare sequence for Ollie, and one that kind of needed to happen to reset the scene. Not that I think anyone could have forgotten what happened in the previous issue, but it resets the tone pretty quick. We're back, or not back, we're now at a hospital with Green Arrow, you know, at Dinah's bedside, and she's doing okay, but, you know, still obviously not in great shape. And in comes the cop from the previous issues, so it's like, okay, who is she? And Ollie's like, oh, I don't know. He's like, yeah, right. And we get more about the whole Yakuza connection with the Japanese archeries and stuff, the Robin Hood killings, and, you know, back on the whole, you know, who's killing all these guys and why. And what I thought was a really nice touch was near the end of that scene, the cop holds up a bunch of evidence of melted arrowheads, and he's like, you know, if you look at it just right, these look like two different types. Kind of a, yeah, maybe our killer didn't do all the killing in this case. Maybe you know this girl more and whatnot, but also kind of a, the cop's not going to press the issue. I think realizing that if Green Arrow did know Dinah, which of course he does, and, you know, the cop was in that position, he'd probably have done the same thing.
And he knows these were bad guys, so...
Yeah. Not like
whatever happened to them, they pretty much deserved, so...
Yeah. We then cut to a tattoo parlor where Ollie is investigating Shadow's dragon tattoo, and, again, finding out about the Yakuza connection. We have a couple of things where, again, we learn more about Shadow's background in training. We then cut to, again, the warehouse district and the businessman, you know, who's, again, behind some of this in terms of, you know, the guys who are getting killed and whatnot. You know, he's part of that circle of guys. And, you know, trying to make sure the shipment happens on time. The usual, you know, hey, we've got drugs coming in or whatnot. Let's not mess this up. Even though, you know, we're all being hunted down by this you know, serial killer with a bow. We then get introduced to Eddie Fires, which this, I believe, is his first appearance. And he showed up for quite a while after this in the Green Arrow stuff, correct?
Yeah.
And
he was hurt. Yeah, he was Ollie's kind of assistant, and then he was the law. He's been the go-to guy for Connor for years.
I had forgotten this is where he'd gotten introduced.
I had also.
He looks a lot different here than he becomes, because he basically becomes a tough guy later on. And here he just looks like an accountant.
He does look like an accountant, but we quickly get to where we realize there's more to him than that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, again, we get to that later. Ollie's still going around investigating, sees a, you know, homeless lady on the street or whatever, who gives him some valuable, you know, clues, which he's then able to track down to the Mount Rainier area. Again, we get that gorgeous, you know, two-page spread of that, you know, scenery and stuff. And then we then see, you know, Ollie in costume out in the snow, where he quickly encounters Shadow, realizing, you know, hey, I've been brought here, how come? And Shadow trying to convince him that, you know, they're after the same thing, their goals are the same, and he's like, ah, no, I tend not to skewer people. And he's like, well, you know, I don't know. And they do the face-off there for a good couple of pages. And this is another case where we get a really nice shot of a close-up on the eyes for both of them. And it's got a very cinematic feel to it. I also like how on page 26, where they're facing off, behind them we get the arrowheads. So the standoff ends when a helicopter comes by, and this is where they're doing the drug deal, the businessmen and whatnot. Meanwhile, Fires is staked out with a sniper rifle to, you know, take care of anyone who gets in the way, which, of course, we know we've got two archers who are, you know, there to do just that. The other helicopter comes by, lands, it's got the drugs, the deal's about to get made, and we get this really nice shot where we've got Green Arrow and Shadow both, you know, set up with their arrows towards the drug deal, and then suddenly Green Arrow turns towards Shadow, fires off his arrow, and it's, okay, is he turning on her or what? And the arrow goes, you know, past her and hits Fires in the shoulder.
Yeah, like kind of like right through her, between her bowstring and her bow.
Yeah, it was, you know, very difficult shot or whatnot. And then we see, yeah, that of course, you know, clues off the drug guys of, hey, stuff going on here. Because I guess she got off her shot and hit either one of the guys. Yeah, hits one of the guys. So as he goes down, some of the other drug guys, you know, take out their machine guns and start firing. You know, Ollie's diving for cover. Meanwhile, Shadow's, you know, taking arrows going through two or three guys at a shot. And helicopter takes off. She gets a shot off, and that gunman goes, you know, head out of the helicopter. The one that came with the drugs takes off and decides that Green Arrow is a bit of a threat to them, so they basically knock him off a cliff. They then go to make sure he's, you know, dead or finish him off if he's not. And what they discover is he didn't land on the ground, you know, the 40 or 50 feet down. He actually managed to land in a tree and get set back up to take a shot at them, which he does, smashing them into the hillside or whatnot. Was it him or...
See, I got the impression that he was going to take the shot, but that it was actually Shadow who took the shot. And it looks like since they zoom in,
yeah,
or they're kind of showing it, it looks like Shadow's the one who took the shot and did something. I think she hit the rotor or something to cause the thing to explode. And
well, at the bottom of 36, Ollie takes the shot, I think he hits the windshield.
Yeah, it does indeed look like his arrow is bouncing off the front of the helicopter, which doesn't seem like he was trying that hard. I mean,
they weren't that far. Yeah, but then
more difficult shots, and then all of a sudden, boom! And then they show shadows waving at him. And I like the 1980s, late 80s context they like stick in here at the end. You know, so you got the guys dumping out the cocaine, you know, getting rid of the evidence. Sure, yes, I am. You know, it's like it turns out he's CIA. They throw in the Iran-Contra stuff. He's like, here, you know, you want this freshly laundered, unmarked and untraceable money? I have gloves on. You know, it's like, I'm not taking it. It's yours, Green Arrow. And the guy just walks away from it. So Green Arrow gets this huge pile of cash.
Cool. And then he goes and confronts the businessman who had set up the whole drug deal. That's when we find out about the whole, you know, military connection. How these guys had wiped the military records clean for them, which is why they didn't have, you know, any connections. And basically, Ollie, you know, tells the guy, you know, hey, the jig is up. Guy reaches for a gun and winds up getting shot through the back with an arrow because of Shadow having been outside on what looks to be like a crane or something. So, you know, Ollie doesn't kill him, but he really sets him up for the kill. And then the epilogue is back at the hospital with Ollie checking on Dinah, who seems to be doing better, saying, you know, hey, I'm going to go get the guys who did this. And he's like, too late. Already took care of it. And, you know, then kind of ending on him mentioning how he got that raise from the CIA guy. Which, again, very different kind of an ending than we usually get for a superhero comic of any way, shape, or form, where, you know, he winds up having, you know, a financial windfall because of all of this.
Typically, that money would be donated to an orphanage or something.
Yet there's no sign that that's going to happen.
Well, he lost his fortune, remember, so it'll be a few fewer flowers they actually have to sell
to
make their cover-up.
Well, and he worked for that money, so, I mean, it wasn't like it came easy. Jeez.
And Sherwood Florist was never really successful in all its time, from what because it kept almost floundering a lot.
Well, it seemed like it also got, you know, smashed up a few times, broken into, and I think maybe even set on fire a time or two. And that's actually one of the things with the Birds of Prey series I find a little disappointing is how they've mentioned her having a florist shop a few times, but we never really see any sign of that.
She got it. The only time she really even got that was right before she left. It was literally right before she left when she also got Helen another job as a teacher. Back in around, I want to say the 90s, back about in the issue, in the 90s, maybe the early, right before she left, actually.
Sounds about right.
Because she said, I bought you this because you love, this is what you want to be, really.
Mm-hmm.
Like your mother and own a floor shop.
It's something that I think they could do more with, also, and you know, obviously the Green Arrow Black Canary series.
That's what they may end up doing because when they finally settle down, for lack of a better term, with their current storyline. I mean, as you were saying earlier, I mean, this story is not one that you could give to a kid and say, you want to read Green Arrow? Here, the current one, you could. But this, there's no way you want to give this to anybody young.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's what makes it good. I mean, as my wife went to, I can't remember the movie she went to see a couple of weeks ago. She said it was nice going to a movie that had cursing. Just every once in a while, just that spoke and acted like normal people speak. And sometimes when you read a comic, it's nice to read something that is aimed at the adult. It's directly said, this is for mature audiences. This is for people that will understand this book. You don't, and when you read it, you are getting a book that is not that's aimed at mature audiences, that aimed at people that would understand all this.
Well, the difference is that this was actually a mature book. It wasn't. A lot of times they call a book mature audience, and why the reason that it's mature audience is because it's got a lot of gratuitous nudity and or violence. And when I say gratuitous, I mean it's just it doesn't need to be there to advance the story. And this book, there was really nothing in here on any of those fronts that wasn't there for a reason, you know, for furthering the story that they were that Grell was telling.
Yeah, that's a excellent point. None of this was the least bit gratuitous. Even the kind of gory violence or whatever and stuff at the end of the second issue, which, you know, aspects of it I found distasteful personally, needed to be there for the story. You know, we had to realize he'd been pushed to a point and beyond, and this is how he reacts. So it was, I felt really, you know, pretty much everything in here was there for a reason to further the characters, the story, the plot, the ongoing stuff. And this had repercussions for Green Arrow, or Green Arrows, plural, I should say, for years to come. This really set the tone and style of the book up until really the last couple of years, you know, when I guess when Kevin Smith came back, that was kind of the start of, I guess, the another era, and then they've since, you know, kind of
Winnick era.
Yeah, started I think maybe even another one with that, and also the year one miniseries they did about 2 years ago, which again, totally different origin than what we get in the first issue here in terms of style, scope, and level of realism.
Well, there's a large part of this that's still reflected today in the current ongoing series with Shadow, because I mean, she does pull. She, I don't know what it was with DC at DC, but they're having their superheroes get knocked out and raped. But she does basically rape Green Arrow in the main series and has a kid, and that's the main reason why in the current ongoing series why she's, spoilers, doing some of the stuff she's doing. Because, I mean, she has a kid by Green Arrow.
Man, when they revealed that she was the one behind some of that stuff.
She was hired by Savannah, I believe, or somebody. I'd have to go back and reread the issue. They kind of blur. But she's the one behind why, basically, Connor got kidnapped.
Yeah, when they revealed some of that, I totally did not see a lot of it coming. It's like, wow, that was an interesting twist.
But it was because her son had been kidnapped.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, she's been a major player in the Green Arrow stuff. That was one of the huge things to come out of this series.
There was another prestige series, Shadow series, that if you haven't read it, it's another one that was very good.
Yeah.
I can't find it for a price I'm willing to pay yet, so I will eventually, but, yeah.
Well, and she also showed up in the Connor Hawk Dragon's Blood miniseries not long ago. She's a character that they could do a lot with, probably a lot more than they're actually doing with her these days. But, I mean, the story on this was great. The art was just fantastic. You know, if you're a long-term Green Arrow fan, and again, want to see the more realistic slant on the character, or if you're a Mike Grell fan and you haven't read this, by all means, go pick it up.
This is, I mean, the art is beautiful. The story is beautiful. I mean, it really does set Grell as one of the very few guys who can do both story and art very well. I mean, there's not a lot of guys who can do both, is there?
I think there's a couple others, but I think you hit a very interesting point here in terms of pretty much everything that's in this issue is his vision, you know, artistically, story-wise, etc. And even when you get a couple of people who can do both, and they are few and far between, I think you rarely get this level of cohesive vision and excellent follow-through on that vision. And I'm trying to think who else has had this kind of ability to really set a new line in the sand for a character and say, from this point forward, this is the take for the character. To a degree, George Perez on Wonder Woman, John Byrne on Superman, Tim Truman on Hawkman. With Perez on Wonder Woman, he was plotting. He wasn't actually scripting originally.
Peter David to a degree on Aquaman.
On the writing side.
On the writing side.
But not on the art.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, on the writing, he totally put a new a benchmark or status quo or whatever for the character. You're right. There's not many that on both the art and the writing have that ability and have, you know, pulled it off.
It's hard to do both. The guy. I mean, a lot of the guys that do it are the people who do creator-owned work, like a Dave Sim.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that was kind of cool about this that we didn't really touch on much at all, although we mentioned it briefly, is, you know, Green Arrow gets a new costume in here. And it's, on the one hand, fairly different than what he had before, but on the other hand, stylistically right in line with it. And it goes towards taking a, you know, his standard superhero costume and giving it more of a classical Robin Hoodish flair to it.
Making it very practical by, as she said, this is what you need for this kind of weather.
Yeah.
And it's also fit, he's using it, a variant of it today. One that a lot of people know from the Justice League, though, from the Justice League JLU, he doesn't use quite this outfit, though.
Yeah.
Now, this is still in print, which is something that is interesting. You know, it's like you can buy the Longbow Hunters trade from in-stock trades right now. It's there and it's available. So for a book to be still in print 20 years later, you know, like this, it is a classic, I think.
Yeah.
I'd be curious as to what edition it's up to.
That would be interesting, how many printings they've done. Wow. And they had 20 years to put it out there, so. Well, and the price at in-stock trades is like, what, $9.42?
Yeah.
You can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, so it's a $14.99 book. So it'd be like, yeah, a $15 book. Even if he bought it off the shelf, it'd be well worth the price.
Yeah. I've got the first printing trade, and it was $12.95. when it was first in trade.
What year? What copyright year do you have on that? Because it used to be the year of the copyright.
89.
So yeah, they put this out right after. So, and that's even, that was high for the day.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think back that far. Were they doing many trades at that point?
I don't think
not
so.
Really?
I was gonna say that seemed early for a trade, but
it's copyright 1987, 1989. So 89 was the. I mean, 87 was when the comics came out.
Yeah.
This was 2 years later, and it was printed in Canada, first printing.
Hmm.
Cover looks different.
That's one thing that why I collect so much of what I do is because it's stuff from that era that I'm not going to be able to find. It's not like everything made pretty much post-2001 where you're going to be able to find it in a trade.
Yeah,
it looks like you have an original cover on this one, whereas the current trade's just got the cover of issue number one as the cover. That's a wrap cover, even.
A lot of it. The art on these, I mean, even the cover art from 1 and 3 are great, too. Leaves a little to be desired, but 1 and 3 are just beautiful.
Yeah, I think the covers are great on this. And I like how he took advantage of the back of the cover to, you know, do some cool stuff. Again, the cityscape, like Bob was mentioning earlier, on the back of the front cover was nice.
One thing that I like about this book, and I've always liked it, is because it is both very set in its time, but it is also kind of ageless. Because, I mean, it is very, you have to understand that the guys they're talking about were in World War II 42 to 47 years before. So these guys are all around, they're in their mid to late 60s. So you have to understand a lot of what the historical implications are. And the characters are too, very late 80s, mid 80s. But it also, you can look at a kid that's probably, well, a kid, I guess, somebody around 20 or 21, you could give this and they could understand the story without the historical part being something that they would just go, I don't understand because of this. The historical part is something that, for those who understand it, yeah, that adds to it. But for people who don't understand it, it doesn't take away from the story.
I guess my question would be on that, aside from obviously the grounding in time with the World War II reference, which I think is necessary and critical for this story, if you kind of give it a little fudge factor there, and ignore that dating it, aside from kind of the look of the street thugs being definitely 80s, which is a minor point, and kind of that Iran-Contra bit at the end, I mean, to me, this holds up very well as a current comic, and aside from those three issues, is very, like you were saying, timeless. I mean, would you agree with that? I mean, obviously the World War II grounding. I mean, you can't get around that.
Yeah.
No, I agree. It seemed to me like the Iran-Contra made it a little more dated than the World War II thing.
Yeah, it just, because we've read a number of things from different eras for the back issue spotlights, and some of them, either in terms of the visual style, the storytelling style, the appearance of the characters, the lingo that they're spouting, can feel very dated. Sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a not so good way. But this, you know, it felt very natural. And if this was coming out today, again, aside from the World War II and Iran-Contra connections, grounding it in a certain point in time, it fits in with the modern sense of storytelling style, the visual style. In other words, it doesn't feel dated in those respects. Certainly, I think it stands out in both of those respects because this is, I think, just, again, exceptionally well done.
It's also helped tremendously by the fact there's very, very little pop culture references to this other than the one dance sequence he has with the older women when he's trying to get information. There's virtually no pop culture references at all in this book.
That's a good point. And that helps keep it timeless. So, anything else, or are we pretty much done?
Other than you guys were reading this stuff as it came out, and you've reread it now, I mean, does it really? How much influence did Grill really have, you think, on the writing people did and the art style? I mean, art style maybe not, but how much writing style do you think Grill influenced other people at the time with this?
I'm going to go with him being a hideously underrated writer because I don't think he gets kind of the respect he deserves, and that I think that this and the series that followed that he did, you know, in combination with his work on Warlord and all those other things Bob was mentioning earlier, I think really set the stage for Hawkworld, for some of the more realistic and sophisticated stories we got later elsewhere. You know, I think he's probably had a bigger influence than most people would realize. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, I would bring it back to John Sable. You know, I think his early independent work at first, I think, you know, which predated this by 4 years, pretty much, I mean, that was really something I think that influenced creators to step outside of the Marvel and DC box as well, in many ways.
Now, touching on that for a minute, you've probably got a better sense of the timeline than I certainly do. Did Grell, where did he start? Was he more at the DC Marvel stuff and then into the independents and then back in, or?
He was definitely started at DC.
Okay.
I mean, his stuff at DC predates. I mean, he was doing the Warlord and Legion and all that stuff in the late 70s. I'm thinking maybe 76-ish time frame.
Sounds about right, yeah.
And John Sable freelance is more like 83, 84. So, I mean, he had quite a few years to establish himself at DC, and then he went and he did Star Slayer and he did Sable, and then he came back to DC, I believe, with Longbow Hunters.
He seemed to take pretty good advantage of the independent boom and popularity in the 80s, and I wish he would do more these days. I'm looking forward to the talk of him doing a Warlord series at DC. Because the last Warlord we got, whoa, that was weak.
Something's gotta wash the taste of Bart Sears out of my mouth on the Warlord character. That was a.
It's kind of funny. I'm looking at mygrill.com. The picture on the front cover on the front page is him holding a longbow with an arrow pointed at the camera. But it also has some pictures of new Warlord pieces, a new cover in the preliminaries for it, plus an unused study for a poster, possibly a future cover, which he's actually selling some of. Yeah.
Cool.
They announced it at Comic-Con that they were going to do a new ongoing, or at least a new series.
Well, and again, he's the guy to do it.
Is that it, I guess?
I think so. Thanks for joining us. It was fun having you on. Thanks for suggesting we do Longbow Hunters also.
Let me know whatever the next one is, and I'll contribute my ramblings, I guess, if y'all want me on again.
Certainly.
All right. Y'all be good, and enjoy your comics.
Cool.
All right.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.